This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us on another cold day in the Upper Great Plains. There is some relief on the way, but in the meantime, many of us have been housebound, you know, maybe binge-watching something on Netflix or this or that, or maybe picking up a book and doing something rather interesting, learning something. And that's what we're going to talk about today with Leticia Mazzero-Hellerud. She's the author of the new book, Turning Points, True Stories of Thriving Through Adversity. And she joins us here in studio. Leticia, thanks for being with us again.
Thank you for having me again, Doug.
We'll tell our listeners that Leticia was in here a couple of years ago when we talked about her first book, Being at Home in the World. And as people can tell from your accent, you're not a native North Dakotan.
Well, I like to joke that this is a South Fargo accent, but most people don't believe me. So, yes, I was born in Burundi, Central Africa, and grew up in a few other countries, including France, Rwanda, and Burkina Faso before resettling as a refugee in Fargo. So this has been home for the past 20 winters.
Well, good to have you here. You're a four-time refugee, though, so you have a lot of experience with moving around under adverse conditions.
That's right.
Well, let's talk about the reason for the turning points, the true stories of thriving through adversity. Why did you write this book?
Well, with the first book, Being at Home in the World, I talked about mostly about my own experience of overcoming adversity. So the feedback that I got from some of my readers was that they enjoyed the stories that I told. That book has stories where I take you back to the countryside where my grandparents lived and also other parts of the globe where I lived. So people loved listening to the stories, even though they were infused with hardships. Say they wanted to come with me on that journey and they enjoyed it. So I thought, like, you know, why not write a book with just stories? And that's when that idea came. But I also wanted to highlight in both books the interconnectedness of people and cultures. So one of the quotes that I really, really like pertaining to turning points is a quote by Melanie Brooks, who is the author of Writing Hard Stories. So she says, "The worst story that we can tell ourselves is that we are alone. Human experience is universal, though the specifics might vary." So she goes on by saying that we find language to unravel the complexities of what happened, and we restitch those complexities into narratives that can become meaningful to others. So she concludes by stating that those are the narratives that have the potential to give others the courage to find their own. So I wanted really to highlight stories from people of various backgrounds, but stories that still highlight our shared humanity. Hence, you know, turning points.
Well, there is a quote in the introduction from your book that I'm going to share with our listeners. "I can think of many times in my own life when I thought it was the end and I truly felt it." And the last story in Turning Points is your own.
That's
revelation,
right.
Correct?
Yes.
So how did you select contributors for this book?
That was a long process. When I sent the request for stories, the only pointers I gave were that I wanted stories where people had to make a U-turn or a sharp turn in their lives. And it didn't matter whether it was like education, employment, relationships, emotional or physical wellness or health. So, and it didn't matter, but at some point in their lives, they had to make that turn. And sometimes it was like their decision, or sometimes it was somebody else making the decision for them, like, "I want a divorce," mm-hmm. or "You are fired."
These are experiences you've had.
Exactly, both of them. So I received many submissions, like twice as much as the 15 stories that I ended up selecting. The other requirement, if I can say, or criteria to select these stories was that the author of those stories had to tell about their experience from a point, a vintage point where you can look back and appreciate the growth that occurred because of that hardship or that tragedy. So these authors had to have become better versions of themselves, and or, you know, because of what had happened to them, they would have found themselves better positioned to fulfill whatever they consider their highest destiny. So some of the stories that did not make the cut were really were also as vulnerable as the stories that the reader will find in Turning Points. But I did not feel that they were there, quite there. They were still in pain. They were still searching and struggling and fighting. And I thought that maybe those people could benefit from reading stories of people who are past that pain, and where they can say, wow, I truly grew because of that turn, that sharp turn.
Getting in that dark tunnel and coming out into the light on the other side.
Exactly.
Well, the stories are told as personal essays, and they're all chapters in the book, and they're led with various quotes from, I think, people that you've taken inspiration from yourself.
That's right.
So these are personal stories.
Yes.
And they range, as you mentioned, from the gamut from people who have had, you know, marriage dissolution, substance abuse, physical issues.
Yes, suicide ideation, you know, and more.
And some of the people who contributed to the book are fine with giving their names. Others chose anonymity.
Yes. My job was really to edit these stories. These stories were written by the people who lived them. So they are my co-authors. My work was mostly to bring them together and to identify the common threads, and also to maybe give them a good introduction and a good conclusion. But the people who lived these experiences wrote those stories themselves. Some of the stories required more editing than others, depending on the level of comfort in writing. But they are not mine. They are not my stories. I have one story in the book as part of the 15. But my co-authors did an amazing job, and I feel very grateful that they chose to share those stories with me to be included in this book that I had envisioned. So I think that it was a lot of trust, and I'm very, very grateful.
Well, this book isn't just about one thing, but there are a number of essays that relate to alcohol and substance abuse.
That's
as
right.
Catalysts for several of the people who shared their stories. Do you have an opinion as a result of, you know, what you've learned putting this book together and what the people you were dealing with have learned in their personal lives about what would be an effective treatment for addiction?
Wow. So I can, again, because it's not my story, and I looked at the stories and appreciated the stories like any other reader, I think I can talk about some of the common threads that I found in those stories and that I also saw in the couple of people who shared their struggles, about the struggles with addiction. So some of these common threads, and again, each person is unique, and I think that, you know, substance abuse or any other struggle, we cope differently, we process tragedy differently. And when it comes to substance abuse, I think it's actually also very important to include or consult with someone who knows something, like a counselor or psychologist or somebody who truly understands how addiction affects us. But some of the things that are the common threads that I thought were evident in these stories, including the stories on addiction, included the belief in a creator, a God or a higher power bigger than ourselves. That's not everybody did not necessarily believe in that, but most people did share about that. The refusal to settle, or really questioning and challenging the status quo. hard work, the belief in self. That was a really big trend. You know, people feeling like they can do better. They can fight. They are worth fighting. And also the recognition of the importance to enroll help. So, and sometimes it was like help in the form of a friend or a neighbor, a relative. But sometimes, most of the time, it was truly involving a professional.
And there seemed to be in each of these stories a moment of self-awareness where that person decided, well, I now know I have this problem and I either can find a way out of it or succumb to it.
And that's true. And most of these people admit to hit rock bottom before truly realizing that this couldn't go on. You know, like either some of them lost relatives and family and friends. Some were afraid of losing like their career or, you know, were on the verge of losing their careers. So, yes, there was a moment of like this cannot go on or I don't have choices. It's either taking that turn and starting from scratch or starting over or, yes, as you said, succumbing to the situation.
At the end of the first chapter in the book, and this is by Dr. MJL, mm-hmm. There's a very interesting sentence that I want to share with our listeners. Because my culture was parochial and self-absorbed, sociocentric rather than outward-looking, it took a long time for me to learn about oppression and bigotry, racism and abuses related to color and ethnicity. This is a different issue we're talking about here, but this is something that you would have some experience with because you come from a very different culture. You have assimilated to a very different culture in your own life. Mm-hmm. Expand on that idea.
Doug, with your permission, can I say not assimilated but integrated?
Please do.
Yes, thank you. Because really, for newcomers, the goal is not to assimilate. The goal is to retain our identity while taking on traits of the new culture that we are embracing. So, but assimilation is like more like losing myself.
Sure.
and really assimilating to the new culture. But, you know, and that's something that I would never be able to fully achieve anyway. So I think we all both benefit from keeping my identity and bringing the strength of my culture to everything I do while I'm learning the traits that will absolutely be needed to be successful in a new culture.
But this mm-hmm. line here, mm-hmm. because my culture was parochial and self-absorbed, sociocentric rather than outward-looking, you could probably apply that to a number of cultures.
Absolutely. That's very true. Yeah. So what was the question again before
I your own personal experience with integrating mm-hmm. into a new culture.
Yes. Oh, yes. So it takes a long time to feel comfortable in a new culture. And yes, you do experience many different, you know, sometimes helpful, sometimes not helpful encounters from people who either don't want you here for their own reasons, you know, like racism being one, or not understanding who you are and assuming that you are a threat or a parasite, if I can say, because some people feel like
refugees
take you know everything that they can take out of the system without contributing. So some people really operate from that place of ignorance or place of fear, and I've experienced that. But I've also experienced people who were genuinely curious about who I was and who refugees are and how they ended up here and how they get ahead, because that's also something that is evident, how fast refugees or immigrants integrate and also get ahead. Many of them start, you know, buying homes or having good careers or starting businesses and going back to school and collecting degrees. So it's there is a trend within immigrants when for people who really want to see. And it can be threatening because it's like, oh, I don't think they pay taxes. Oh, maybe they don't even pay rent. Maybe the government pays everything, and that's why they are so able to get ahead so fast. But I think it's a mindset that actually one of my favorite books about the topic was written by, I think it's Marsha E. Steele, and the title of the book is Making It in America, and the subtitle is What Immigrants Know That Most Americans Have Forgotten. And it's talking about really seeing opportunities everywhere, and almost like a kid in a candy store. Oh my gosh, I can go back to school at any time. Oh my gosh, I can have two jobs, you know. I can start a business. I can buy a home. So all those kind of things, exciting things, and that we didn't necessarily have access to back home.
And this is a theme of the book, actually. Mm-hmm. This is Leticia Mazzaro-Hellerud. She's the author of Turning Points, True Stories of Thriving Through Adversity. You could say that these people who've written these essays are refugees from their past, and they've discovered a new life, a new time, because there is a theme in this book of optimism, of that people have come from a very pessimistic view of their lives to a very optimistic one.
And that's true. And that's, again, one of the things that I love when people start telling stories and how powerful it is. But here we are talking about none of the people in this book, the 14 co-authors, are not refugees. I am the only refugee or past refugee in that book.
Well, I was using it symbolically.
Yes, mm-hmm. But you're going back to really the core of the book, because I'm also highlighting the interconnectedness of people and stories and cultures. But yes, you come from that place of darkness, that place of powerlessness, to and through optimism and hard work, get to a better place altogether. And yeah, so I like that you were able to make that analogy.
Now, many people do not thrive through adversity. And sometimes that might be because that one person who could have helped wasn't there, or whatever catalytic, you know, whatever happened to the people who succeeded didn't happen to them. Do the people around someone going through a personal crisis have a responsibility to do something?
I come from a collectivistic culture or society, and living here in a rather individualistic culture, I personally believe that yes, you know, I'm my brother's keeper.
It takes
my
a village.
Sister's, it does take a village. So I think that it's important to reach out when you see someone who's struggling. Sometimes they might not be ready, and I think it's important to find the best way to approach that person without judgment and with empathy. Even though the person might be defensive, sometime, you know, hopefully in the middle of the night when, you know, it's like, you know, me versus me, when I'm really, you know, going in my heart of heart and thinking about my life, if I'm struggling, I might say, Doug was right, you know, or Doug had a point, you know, when he reached out and saying, I think you have a problem, or I'm thinking about mostly addiction. But there are some other problems that are easier to enroll help or accept help. But I think it's important not to shut our eye or keep our mouth shut. I think it's important to talk and to connect and lend a hand. Yes, it does take a village indeed.
We live with each other.
Yes, that's for sure.
Leticia Mazzaro-Hellerud is the author of Turning Points, True Stories of Thriving Through Adversity. How can people get the book?
If you are in Fargo-Moorhead area, you can get the book at Zandbro's Variety on Broadway or Red River Coffee Company on 52nd and 25th. But anyone else can get the book from Amazon.
All right. Well, yeah. Thank you for being our guest today.
Thank you so much, Doug, for having me.
More Main Street in a moment.
On this week's North Dakota Legislative Review, We'll hear from North Dakota Senator Joan Heckman, who is the Senate Minority Leader. She'll talk about her party's concerns and hopes for the 2019 legislative session, including their stance on some of the big-ticket items. I'm Dave Thompson. Join us for Legislative Review Friday at 6:30 p.m. Central, 5:30 p.m. Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
Well, it's time to remind our listeners that we are member-supported radio, Ashley.
Absolutely. What does that mean? It means there are people who are listening who say, I can put a dollar value on what I hear here and support this service. And it starts with a simple phone call, 1-800-359-4145. You can also click and join at prairiepublic.org, or you can text the word support to 484848. And when you are calling in support of Main Street, you are supporting a show that fosters meaningful conversation. Our last guest here on this show had 20 minutes to talk about her life. This is not a 90-second news cycle here. We cover the arts, science, even some sports here and there. We take the time to get it right and to have meaningful conversations. And that's what you're supporting when you call 1-800-359-4145 or click and join at prairiepublic.org. And now during the short and sweet.
Yeah, that's a little bit of a special gift for those people who become members. You get some of Nicole Fine Pastry truffles, these wonderful truffles. They, in a one-pound silky box wrapped in a purple ribbon, delivered anywhere in the continental United States in time for Valentine's Day. Just contribute $15 a month and you'll get two boxes. $20 a month will get you three boxes. $10 a month gets you one, and maybe that's all you need. But remember, the important thing you're doing isn't buying truffles. You're supporting Main Street and Prairie Public's radio network because it's a service you're using right now.
Shows like Main Street take a lot of time. We listen to these interviews. There's a lot of research that's done in advance. Sometimes the interviews are a little bit better with some editing, and that all takes time. So think about all the things that turn out a little bit better in your life if you take the time to do them properly. Well, that's how radio works, too. That's why we're such high-quality offerings here on Prairie Public, whether you're here for the news department with Dave, Danielle, and Todd covering the entire state, or if you are here for the entertaining weekend shows like Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, or the long-form discussion shows like Reveal. All of that takes time, and that means takes money as well. 1-800-359-4145 or online at prairiepublic.org. Starting at just $10 a month gets you a one-pound box of decadent cocoa truffles.
Prairie Public is in Beach, Bismarck, Bowman, Crosby, Devil's Lake, Dickinson, in Fargo, two places in Grand Forks, two frequencies, Hedinger, Jamestown, Minot, Thief River Falls, Tioga, Williston, a couple of sticks there as well, in Plentywood, Montana. So that kind of a network requires support. Yeah, there's a fair amount of it out there to get this signal all across the state. And you can help by giving us a call, 1-800-359-4145, going online to prairiepublic.org, clicking donate, or text the word support to 484848 and click on the link we send. Coming up on Main Street, Sue Balcom with some Super Bowl snack ideas, and we'll have our What's Happening list of things to do. But first, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The State Senate Appropriations Committee has approved a plan to give state workers a 2% raise in the first year of the upcoming biennium and a 3% salary increase in the second year. But that 2 and 3 plan goes farther.
We are going to be adding funds for a 2 and a 3% increase on foundation aid for the schools, 2 plus 3 on higher ed, and then the providers in human services, which would be long-term care and DD providers and those folks, would get a 2 and a 3.
Grand Forks Republican Senator Ray Holmberg chairs the Appropriations Committee.
The pie is only so big, and we were looking at the whole pie.
House Appropriations have been considering a 2-2 plan for state employee salary increases. Both plans continue the fully paid health insurance plan for state employees. Holmberg says this is also dependent on the March revenue forecast. A Fargo lawmaker has sponsored a bill to provide $45 million in research grants to be split between UND and NDSU. The idea came from the Valley Prosperity Partnership. The money would come from the earnings from the state's legacy fund. The partnership had originally proposed $100 million for those grants, but the main sponsor, Fargo Republican Senator Ron Sorvog, says with all the demands on those legacy fund proceeds, $45 million seemed more doable. However, he told reporters,
"So this will be a significant, predictable investment in the future of North Dakota. This will help bring us to the 21st century, and it will help establish and provide opportunities for a skilled workforce."
NDSU President Dean Bresciani says North Dakota has two top research universities, but does not provide dollars directed toward research. He says when the partnership approached him about this idea, he was excited.
"Because I saw the potential of our state's two research universities to contribute far more to the state's economy than they've ever had the capacity to do. What they've accomplished is commendable, if not outstanding, but what we could contribute to the state of North Dakota is nothing short of exciting."
The bill is now pending in the Senate Appropriations Committee. And nowhere has the dangerous cold been tougher than at local shelters and on the homeless. Jan Eliason is executive director of the Gladys Ray Shelter in Fargo.
"Normally we can serve about 35 people, and if we get 35 people in that building, it starts to feel pretty full. On average right now, the last few nights, we're looking at 44, 45 people. We had 51 on Saturday. And typically in the daytime, we operate a veterans drop-in center, but we just haven't been closing at all. We're really encouraging people to stay indoors and stick out the day with us."
At Churches United for the Homeless in Moorhead, overflow beds have been set up the past several nights. At the new Life Center in North Fargo, some people have been put up in the waiting room as 115 beds are filled. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg, and we have root cellar Sue Balcom by our microphone in Bismarck.
Sue, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
What are you going to be doing on Sunday?
Oh, my gosh, eating. Let's see, we're eating, and watching TV commercials, which is one of my favorite things as a marketing person.
It interrupts the game, doesn't it? Yeah, oh. The Rams and the Patriots in the Super Bowl.
I think you mean it the other way around. Yeah. The game interrupts the eating.
That's what I meant,
right?
Yeah.
Well, there we go, right, because people rush out of the kitchen to see the next play. But, see, I always catch them on the replay or the challenge or whatever, and then that way you get to see it from 15 different angles because I still don't get the game.
It is the longest game of the year, of course, and of course, so there's plenty of time to nosh. And you know, what are you proposing this year?
Well, you know, everybody usually has chili. That's one of the big standbys for Super Bowl. But I found these two great, really short recipes that I experimented with last weekend that are phenomenal and would go great with chili. And one of them is cheese chips. Now, you guys made an omelet before or anything like that where the cheese runneth over, and after you're cleaning up the dishes, you've got somebody out there prying those little bits of cheese off the pan and eating them all crispy. Well, I found a recipe where, and I don't know why I didn't do this before, you take cheddar cheese, use real cheese. Don't use the kind that's pre-shredded. You should shred this yourself. And you just take a tablespoon of cheese mounded on a piece of parchment paper on a cookie sheet, and then lay a nice jalapeno pepper, pickled or fresh, on there, and bake them in 375 degree oven till they're the color you want them. Like, I like them really dark. My husband likes them a little lighter. Then let them cool, and you have these, like, phenomenal cheese chips that go perfect with a bowl of chili.
Sue, you will not believe this, but I've been making these chips for a long time.
And you didn't tell us?
They are so easy, and I discovered them exactly the way you said. You know, we love that kind of fried cheese that ends up in the pan or whatever
cheese
when you're
leavens.
Making a cheese sandwich or something like that. So a light bulb goes on.
I know, and it's so weird because every time we do that, I'm like, to my husband, I'm like, why don't we just cook the cheese and leave the chips out of the baking sheet, you know, and see what we get.
The important piece here, though, is the parchment paper.
Yes.
You've got to have that.
Correct. That and the quality of cheese. What kind of cheese do you use?
I mix it up, and sometimes I'll put a little cayenne pepper in there, maybe a little other, you know, spicy flavor, even hot sauce, because it helps hold the stuff together.
Awesome.
I mean, I like a little heat.
So do I, and so I've got these fermented pickled jalapenos that I made, and I opened the jar to make these on Sunday, and I'm not kidding you, it ran over like a frothy champagne, and I'm thinking, yay, we did it. But anyway, now my second, you've got to try this too. I love olives. I love really expensive olives, but you can also get green olives in great big jars from like Sam's or Walmart for a really reasonable price. And I found this blistered olive recipe that is phenomenal, you guys. If you like green olives, this is going to make them five times as good. And all it is green olives, a jar of green olives drained, and some fresh garlic, about a teaspoonful, a teaspoon of red chili flakes, which we always have on hand at our house, mm-hmm. and a tablespoon of olive oil and the zest of a lemon. And what you're basically doing is you're heating your olive oil and throwing the rest of the ingredients in there until your olives start to get brown.
Oh.
You can eat them warm, but I'm telling you, if you put them in the refrigerator overnight, they're phenomenal.
These sound great.
They do.
They're so good, you guys, and it was such an easy recipe. I knew I had to share
with
it with
some cheese chips.
Oh, yeah. See, that's why I'm thinking the same
thing. And a bowl of chili.
And a bowl of chili. And then after you eat your big meal, you've got to have guacamole. Mm-hmm. Super Bowl Sunday would not be Super Bowl Sunday without guacamole.
I bet that the single day sales of avocado, I mean, it's got to be one of the highest days of the year.
Well, and you know, they always advertise, the Avocado Association always advertises during the Super Bowl Sunday because they figure that we eat 53 million pounds of guac.
Wow.
Super Bowl Sunday.
I mean, well, I have to catch up.
That's crazy. And we eat guacamole a lot, and it's an in-season fruit. It's not a vegetable. It's an in-season fruit right now with lots of protein. So regardless of the thing in the back of your head that says don't eat them, they have fat in them. They are a good fat, and they've got a lot of protein. And the Brazilians, you'll love this, Ashley, are the ones that finally put them in ice cream. And I know that you've
had avocado ice cream. It is quite good.
But guacamole is like the most simple thing you can make, and we eat it whenever I can get them ripe, which they don't ripen on the tree. You have to buy them and buy them semi-hard, like press your thumb into the tiny end up there, and if it just gives a little bit, those are the ones you want to buy. And then if you aren't going to eat them right away, which they're probably a little hard when you get them home from the store, you can do two things. You can put them in a bag with a banana, or you can put them in your flour bin, but put a big note on your refrigerator that says, check your avocados in 2 days.
Okay. In the flour bin.
Yes, I've left them in there and come back to like green mold and have to throw out all my flour. But yeah, there's something about putting them in your flour bin that ripens them just like a banana does in a bag. And I always have flour at my house, of course.
But this is something you have to make sort of at the moment, isn't it? Otherwise it gets brown. I mean, and I see you got some lemon juice there. But
correct. So once they're ripe, you kind of have them with a big old knife just kind of around the equator there from north to south, if you can figure that one out. Open them up, whack the seed with the knife, pull that out, and then take and I usually soak I soak about a half a teaspoon of salt and probably a clove of garlic or two in a bowl with some lemon juice from a fresh lemon. I just let that sit for a while. Then when you're ready to eat, that's when you want to open that avocado because they do turn brown, but not fast enough in our house to consume that whole bowl before it does. So then you just mash your avocado in there. We like it chunky. And we like it plain like that. We eat a lot of it just plain. But for Super Bowl, if you want to dress it up, you can add things like half a can of Rotel tomatoes with chilies, or you can chop up fresh green onion and tomato in there. You can add bacon bits. You can use a lime, which, of course, limes and lemons are both in season right now. And I actually went into the store just to double check. And yes, they are in our local grocery stores here, even way up north. So you've got to have some avocados. They're good for you. And buy the Haas, You know, the Haas are the smaller ones with the really alligator kind of skin on them. They have much more flavor than those larger Florida ones do.
Well, I didn't know that.
Yes, and definitely we want to support the industry because we only grow 10% of the avocados we eat in California, and the rest of them are imported from either Mexico or Chile or someplace like that. So we got to eat those avocados and keep them coming. That's one thing we can't really grow up here in the Great White North.
Yeah, there's that.
Well, what else can we have with our chili?
Well, you know, I found this. I do a lot of yeasty breads and sourdough breads. And one day I thought, I need something to use up all those pickled jalapenos because I have jars and jars of them in my house. And so I was Googling recipes and found a jalapeno cheese soda bread.
Mm-hmm.
And I will post that recipe in its entirety on my website at therootsellers.com. But it's basically flour, baking powder, baking soda, grated cheese, and chopped up jalapenos. It takes, you know, 5 minutes to put it together. It bakes in about maybe 30 minutes, and the stuff is phenomenal. The jalapenos give that bread just a wonderful flavor. It's kind of like eating a big biscuit.
Oh, yeah.
And I love biscuits, you know, crunchy on the outside. And I found this wonderful white cheese at Walmart in great big chunks, and it's tangy, tangy aged cheddar that makes this bread just phenomenal.
Oh, yummy. So tasty bread, blistered olives, guacamole, cheese chips, and finally a team with some male cheerleaders.
Yes!
Let's get
go
into this
Rams!
Super Bowl.
All right. Well, Sue, if somebody wants to find out your recipe online, how do they do that?
Just visit The Root Sellers, and that's S-E-L-L-E-R-S, not seller, .com. And if you Google me, you'll find me everywhere. And I also have a link to the Main Street Eats podcast that you can listen to all our episodes at a later date.
We talk with Sue Balcom every week. Always a pleasure, Sue.
Thank you.
What's happening is next.
Coming up this week on the Thomas Jefferson Hour, we speak to President Jefferson about the importance of freedom of the press.
He was a man of the Enlightenment, and he famously said, given the choice between government without newspapers or newspapers without a government, I would not hesitate to prefer the latter, newspapers.
And we talked to President Jefferson a bit about his ideas about what a free press should do and how he got his news.
He said all of the right things in the course of his life. He was a little prickly, like all presidents, about the press that was so hard on him and he thought unfair. But as he, I think, wisely understood, that comes with the territory. That's the cost of human liberty.
He wrote to Lafayette, the only security of all is in a free press.
But he also said that in one of his moments of exasperation that newspapers should be divided into four sections: truth, probabilities, possibilities, and bald lies.
Join us for all that and more on this week's Thomas Jefferson Hour.
Sunday at 11 Central, 10 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg. And you're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public because members' support over the years has made it possible. We're in our short and sweet membership drive, Ashley.
And the sweet part of the member drive is those decadent cocoa truffles. So stop what you're doing and listen to this phone number, 1-800-359-4145. Or you can click and join and become a member at prairiepublic.org. Or if you have a smartphone, you can send a text message. It's very simple. It's the word support to the number 484848. And then we'll send you a link and you can fill out the form from there. And what you're doing is providing a very important revenue source here at Prairie Public, money that we use to pay for the programs that we either purchase or that we have to buy in order to bring you on the air. And if you start at just $10 a month, you get a one-pound box of cocoa truffles from Nicole's Fine Pastry in time for Valentine's Day to anywhere in the continental United States. And boy, are these good.
And of course, listeners who become members are supporting Main Street on Prairie Public. You're supporting the Prairie Public Radio Network as well. And I guess we look at it as a testimonial to the work the three of us do. That's Skip Wood, Ashley Thornburg, and me, Doug Hamilton, every day, every weekday from 3 to 4 and from 7 to 8 when the program is rebroadcast across the Prairie Public Network at Central Time, because you've made it possible. help make it possible for, you know, the future as well. Pay it forward. Give us a call, 1-800-359-4145, or go online to prairiepublic.org and click on Donate. Or, as Ashley suggested, text the word support to 484848 and just click on the link we send. For those of you who have, thank you.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
That's the question we always ask on Thursdays here on Main Street. You know, what's happening for the weekend? And Ashley Thornburg and I have a list of things you might want to look at.
How about a winter farmers market? Of course, it's going to feel like summer by the time we get our weekend temperatures after this polar vortex, but it is still winter. So February 2nd, 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. in Fergus Falls, Minnesota, there is a winter farmers market. So this is people who still have fresh eggs available, and then also things like honey and homemade jams and jellies. Sometimes there are apples, some canned pickles, krumkak even. So want to go out on the sweet end there with some Scandinavian deliciousness. The Winter Farmers Market, February 2nd, 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. in Fergus Falls in the Riverfront Square.
Well, how about the Optimus Spaghetti Feed? That is Friday from 5 to 7 at the Jamestown Civic Center. The meal is spaghetti, salad, and ice cream. It costs $10 for an adult, $5 for students, and all proceeds benefit youth programs in Jamestown and the Imagination Library. So take it in Friday from 5 to 7 at the Jamestown Civic Center.
It's hard not to be optimistic about carbs and sugar and libraries. Come on. All right, here's another one at a library. This is a baby play on February 1st from 10 to 11 at the Minot Public Library. This is a sensory play activity for kids ages 6 months to 3 years and their caregivers. Stories, songs, some interactive play time, because of course the best kind of learning is the fun kind of learning. So Baby Play Day, February 1st, 10 to 11 a.m. at the Minot Public Library.
Well, the Fargo Public Library downtown has a pretty interesting program for kids, too. It's Arg, Ahoy Matey. It's a pirate ferry adventure at the main library. It's Saturday from 11 to noon. Get ready to sail for adventure and sprinkle fairy dust along the way to Pixie Hollow. It's a day full of pirates and fairies. We'll make some special fairy crafts and enjoy some of our favorite piratey snacks, all while watching the Disney movie The Pirate Fairy. This event is open to all ages, but is most appropriate for children 4 and up. All materials will be provided and no pre-registration is required. So head to the downtown Fargo Library from 11 to noon for Ahoy Matey, It's a Pirate Fairy Adventure.
Well, if you've been stress eating your way through the polar vortex, you might want to get some free health screenings at the Bridging Health and Home in Mayville at the West Trail Ambulance Building Center. You can go and get your blood pressure checked. You can ask questions about just your general health, maybe some medication that you're on, blood sugar levels, lipid testing. And then if you are having an issue, they can connect you to some resources. Again, this is at the Ambulance Center in Mayville. This is open on Tuesdays from 8:30 to 11:30 a.m.
Grief Journeys for Adults Support Group is on February the 6th from 10 in the morning until 11:30. It's at the Sun Center South at Mayville, North Dakota. Hospice of the Red River Valley will offer a free ongoing grief support group for adults 18 years and older who've experienced a loss through death. The group meets on the first Wednesday of each month from 10 till 11:30 at Sun Center South. That's in Mayville. This group is free and open to the public. So if you need this service, it's February 6th from 10 to 11:30 at Sun Center South in Mayville, Grief Journeys for Adults Support Group.
Wahpeton is celebrating 150 years, and so this weekend there are indoor and outdoor activities that kick off a whole year-long celebration of all things Wahpeton. So TAL's Super Bowl pick, TAL is this wonderful orangutan who calls the Chahinkapa Zoo home, and he can play music and apparently pick the Super Bowl winner. Well, he can pick a Super Bowl winner. We'll see if he picks the Super Bowl winner. There's going to be a pork feed, a waffle breakfast, a gun raffle, an open house at the zoo, a snowmobile run, fireworks, ice fishing, snow sculpting. Check out Wahpeton150.com for all things Wahpeton 150.
Danny Girl by Michael Kuman and Christopher Diamond is going to be playing at Theater B. This is the work of guest artists with Wheelhouse Theatrical Productions, formerly known as Music Theater Fargo-Moorhead. Wheelhouse presents Danny Girl, the musical Good for the Soul. It will be on stage February 1st and through the 3rd and February 7th through the 10th. Performances are at 7:30 p.m. with Sunday matinees at 2 p.m. Tickets, adults, $25. Senior matinee tickets, $20. Student tickets, $12. With student tickets on Thursdays, $7.
All right, my pick of the week is Cabin Fever Days in Jamestown. This is actually going on February 1st through the 10th. The Jamestown Parks and Rec Department is working with local community members to have an active winter. So important to stay active even in these temperatures. So cross-country skiing, sleigh riding, basketball tournaments. You can check out more on the Parks and Rec website in Jamestown. Cabin Fever Days, the 1st through the 10th.
Reading at the Rourke Hunter's Log, Volumes 2 and 3 will take place Saturday at the Rourke Art Gallery in Moorhead from one of the last works of the late prairie poet Timothy Murphy. Knew the fellow. He was very gifted. This event is also a showcase of Murphy's collection of the late Charles Beck's woodcuts. Murphy and Beck were friends and collaborators, with several of Beck's woodcut images appearing on Murphy's book covers. These literary and visual artists found inspiration in the same landscape. The North Dakota State University Press will be launching Hunter's Log, Volumes 2 and 3, with poems read by Murphy's brother, Jim Murphy, and friends. The event is free, open to the public. Light refreshments will be served. Again, it takes place Saturday from 3 to 5:30 p.m. at the Rourke Art Gallery and Museum in Moorhead. And that's what's happening.
Well, I mean, I always listen to public radio, but I never gave them money. I mean, like, that would be like giving in. I would go to my friends and see a public radio mug or a t-shirt and say, ha ha, they got you, with their stupid pledge drives, but they won't get me. I hear the pledge drives, I just tune it out. Ha! But then last year I went to my girlfriend Kiki's house and she gave me a piece of this chocolate and it was like sweet. And she said it was public radio chocolate and I knew I was done for. So I joined up. I'm a member. They use chocolate. It's not fair.
Give in to the power of chocolate. Click and join online at prairiepublic.org. $10 a month gets you a box of decadent hand-rolled cocoa truffles from Nicole's Fine Pastry.
This is Dakota Datebook for January 31st. The 1st Regiment of the North Dakota Infantry was organized on this date in 1885. The infantry would later become the foundation of the North Dakota National Guard and the 164th Infantry Regiment of the U.S. Army. During the 1860s, Dakota Territory Governor William Jayne issued proclamations calling for the organization of volunteer militias to defend and protect Dakota Territory. Jayne was motivated after the federal government reassigned many of the Army troops serving in Dakota military posts to southern states to fight in the Civil War. The governor believed Dakota Territory was left vulnerable and undefended. The newly created Dakota Territorial Militia was underfunded and underprovisioned and existed as a loose organization until 1885, when 1,000 members were formally recognized as the 1st Regiment of North Dakota. 4 years later, North and South Dakota were divided, and the North Dakota State Constitution authorized one guard regiment of 10 companies. In 1898, the regiment was called up for duty to defend the Philippines from the Spanish. 8 companies were selected and organized into the North Dakota Volunteer Infantry Regiment. The regiment was activated again in 1916 to defend the U.S. border with Mexico, then months later for service in World War I. In 1917, state regiments were numbered with the state designations eliminated. That's when the North Dakota Infantry became the 164th Regiment. In November of 1917, the regiment traveled to France to join the American Expeditionary Forces. During World War II, the unit found itself in the Pacific Theater of War, ordered to relieve Marine forces pinned down on Guadalcanal. On October 13th, the 164th became the first U.S. Army unit in World War II to offensively engage the enemy. For their actions, the unit earned a Presidential Unit Citation, as well as the respect of their Marine cohorts. The unit was authorized to wear the first Marine Guadalcanal patch on their uniforms and became known as the Little Marines, or the 164th Marines. Marine Commander Puller later remarked on the 164th, "Those farm boys can fight." The unit also saw action during the Korean War in 1951, but it was eventually converted into engineering battalions. Today, the 164th provides engineering and officer training as part of the North Dakota Army National Guard. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Jamie Jobe. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
A scientist in the U.S. is conducting a controversial new experiment.
What are you doing today?
We are fixing some mutations in human embryos.
While his peers debate whether his research is ethical,
it has value,
and safe.
Anyone with a connection to the internet will be able to download the recipe to make a designer baby.
Inside the Lab, on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
A little time left to remind you that we are in our short and sweet membership drive. This is when we ask our listeners to become members to support what you're listening to right now, and we've got a little incentive.
And that incentive is my favorite incentive of all year. It is a one-pound box of Nicole's Fine Truffles. This is a pastry shop that just could be equally at home in Paris as it is in North Dakota, and you get to just relish in these fantastic cocoa truffles. What a wonderful way to just continue that membership, that feeling, that camaraderie that you have with public radio. You know you love to get together with friends and have drinks or chocolate or what have you. Well, your friends are on the radio sometimes, so have chocolate while you're listening to public radio. The number to call is 1-800-359-4145, or you can click and join online at prairiepublic.org or text the word support to 484848.
And we'll send you, if you give us $10 a month, a box of these truffles anywhere in the continental United States in front of Valentine's Day. It'll arrive in time in a nice box with a beautiful ribbon on it. Just give us a call, 1-800-359-4145, online at prairiepublic.org, or text support to 484848 and click on the link. For those of you who have done that, our deepest thanks. Friday on Main Street, the old school in Nome, North Dakota, has stood silent and abandoned for more than five decades, but now it's being repurposed. We'll hear about this ambitious plan to turn it into a fiber mill, an arts facility, a community center, and a bed and breakfast from Teresa Perleberg and Chris Armbrust. And, of course, Dave Thompson will be here to talk about the news, Madeline with a new movie. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.